This is State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. In 2004, about 50 kids connected to a single high school in a suburb of Grand Rapids became addicted to heroin.
There's just a big old group of them. There's some still to this day that are out there using.
It was one of the earliest signs of an epidemic that's raged across Michigan and the country in the years since. An epidemic of drug addiction to a class of drugs called opiates. More than 3,000 people in Michigan alone have already died from this epidemic since 2005.
You're going to be shocked at how many people you meet that are dealing with this on a personal level. You know, it's rampant.
I'm Dustin Dwyer. This hour, we'll go back to that early outbreak in 2004 to see what happened afterward and how Michigan failed to respond to one of the deadliest public health epidemics in its history. This is a State of Opportunity documentary from Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. Mary DeBoer still remembers how it felt in the winter of 2004.
Everything was fine. You know, there was no threat or scariness to that something was imminent, that something was going to happen.
We're sitting at her kitchen table as the sun goes down behind her. This is the table where she, her husband, and her three children would gather for dinner every night. No matter what else was going on, they all sat down for dinner at this table at 6 o'clock. Until their last night together, on December 14th, 2004.
Funny thing, we were eating dinner and I had made French dips. Then I ran out of roast beef, so like three of them I made with ham instead of with the roast beef. And Matt got one with ham. And just was like, are you serious, Mom? And he's not throwing a fit, but being funny about this French dip that wasn't a French dip.
Matt was 17 years old, still in high school. He loved animals. He wrote poetry. He played video games. He listened to Eminem and 50 Cent. He had a part-time job. He was a kid. He'd had his problems. But on this evening, as he gave his mom a hard time over ham sandwiches, things were good. Mary says after dinner, she cleaned up the kitchen and sat down.
Matt headed downstairs to do some homework, and we were sitting in the front room, and I saw Chris's car go past.
Chris Perrin, a friend of Matt's, a friend who Mary thought of as a bad influence, a friend she didn't really want her son hanging around.
And that's kind of different. That's kind of weird. So I immediately went downstairs. And Matt was gone.
That was the last time Mary DeBoer saw her son alive. He was found the next morning in a car with his sleeve rolled up and a needle mark on his arm. The medical examiner declared it a heroin overdose. There were news stories and an investigation and a trial. There were memorials and awkward encounters at the grocery store with people who had no idea what to say. Over the years, those things faded. And still, Mary DeBoer lives with her loss. The pain hasn't faded.
Every day, he's the first thing I think of when I wake up and the last thing I think about at night. And it's 10 years later.
You're listening to State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. This hour, we're going to be talking about the death of Matthew McKinney. We're talking about it because of what happened afterward, or rather, what failed to happen. In the months after Matthew McKinney's death, police learned a great deal about heroin use in the community where McKinney lived. They determined that in just that one town, Granville, a suburb of Grand Rapids, 50 kids or more had become addicted to heroin. Nearly all of them started on it the same way, First, they experimented at parties with prescription painkillers like Vicodin and OxyContin. When they developed an addiction and they couldn't maintain the addiction with expensive prescription drugs, they looked for a cheaper alternative that gave them the same high, heroin. Granville was one of the first communities in Michigan where this problem popped up. Matthew McKinney was one of the first victims. But he wasn't the last. In the years since, the Centers for Disease Control declared that addiction to prescription drugs had become an epidemic. In 2009, there were more deaths from drug overdoses in the U.S. than from car accidents, and the numbers have only gone up since then. In Michigan, more than 3,000 people are dead from these drugs since 2005. Imagine it was anything else that killed them. Anything other than drugs. A deadly virus. Chemical spill. How would the response have been different? Matthew McKinney was born with a broken heart. It was a defect called tetralogy of Fallot. When he was 3 months old, his mom found him in the nursery, blue. She thought he was gone. He was rushed to Ann Arbor for surgery. For the rest of his life, he carried a scar on his chest, a constant reminder that he was not like other kids.
Yeah, and we kept trying to tell him, well, that's your badge of courage. You know, don't be ashamed of that. That's your badge of courage. You can do anything you want.
But he couldn't. Not really. Mary says Matt was into sports, but unlike other friends at school, he couldn't play on teams. His heart couldn't handle it. So he found friends who were into other things.
Yep, stealing and smoking pot, and then, you know, that just led on to other things.
This is one of Matt's closest friends growing up. His name's Jason. He only wanted me to use his first name.
How did you meet Matt?
We went to elementary school together. We just shared a lot of laughs. He was a great, great person to be around. Always had my back.
He says Matt was always a good kid, but that started to change around middle school. Matt's mom says by the time he was 15, she felt helpless to stop him.
He would sneak out of the house in the middle of the night and be gone. And I can remember asking a police officer one time, you know, we didn't even know he was gone. And I said, you know, can I put a lock on his door? He had an upstairs bedroom, and I wanted to just put a lock on it. And he said, if you do that, ma'am, we'll see you in court for child abuse.
Things got worse from there. And eventually, Mary realized her son had an addiction problem with alcohol. In the summer of 2004, she sent him to an addiction center for teens in Minnesota. But while Matt was away, Jason says another problem was growing among a group of kids at Granville High School.
I think that they were doing OxyContin, and it kind of just led to that, like Vicodin, and then I don't know how, but it just spread like wildfire.
Vicodin and OxyContin are opiates, same as heroin. And this kind of drug is powerfully addictive. Quitting can cause a painful withdrawal that can last weeks. So when the pills in the medicine cabinet ran out, the kids in Granville could try to keep getting them in other ways, which were expensive and tricky. Or they could switch to heroin, which was cheaper and sometimes easier to get.
When I was a junior, I knew like a lot of people were doing heroin. And
like how many people?
Oh, there's a lot. There's just a big old group of them. There's some still to this day that are out there using.
Good afternoon, Dustin. I'm Ray Beckering. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Western District of Michigan. In 2004, our local DEA office received multiple calls from families, actually, in Granville, concerned that their children, ages 16 to 22, were addicted to heroin. In the various investigations that occurred in 2004 and 2005, I would say DEA and the U.S. Attorney's Office investigated almost up to 48 or 50 different individuals who'd become addicted to heroin.
That's 50 that we know of, so that's a minimum?
That's right. Those are the people that we actually interviewed in these cases.
When I first heard this number, I didn't believe it. No way a group of 50 kids from one school gets addicted to heroin. That just doesn't happen. But not only did it happen in Granville in 2004, in the years since, it's happened many more times. It's not even that rare.
It's just, it's so sad. I belong to a group that it's through Compassionate Friends, but it's for parents, mothers with kids that have died of substance abuse. And every day there's a new one on there. Every day.
From 2010 to 2013, the death rate from heroin overdoses nearly tripled in the United States. Michigan's been one of the hardest hit states in the overall epidemic involving opiates. And we're used to hearing about drug epidemics in the United States that come and go. But this one is different, in part because it's claimed many more lives than previous epidemics. The death rate from drug overdoses in the United States right now is about twice what it was in the 1980s during the crack epidemic. But this epidemic is also different in how it got started.
From your point of view, like, how did we even get here? How did this even happen?
And I'm asking this question to a doctor named William Maroney. He does addiction counseling in the Thumb area. He also serves as a county medical examiner, so he sees the effects of drug overdose up close.
I'm going to say something that's very controversial, and it's really going to burn a bridge somewhere. Somewhere around 98, 99, 2000, the Joint Commission on Hospital Accreditation, otherwise known as JCAHO at that time, forced all healthcare providers to embrace pain as a fifth vital sign.
You may be aware of when this actually happened. Doctors and nurses started asking patients to rate their pain on a scale from 1 to 10, and the hospitals expected those numbers to go down over time. Maroney says the problem is doctors didn't actually get trained on dealing with chronic pain, but they did have access to strong new pain relievers, Oxycontin, Vicodin. Prescriptions for these drugs shot up like crazy.
We're talking about a problem where certified medical doctors are actually killing people.
We're talking about certified medical doctors are maximizing their profits and are not in tune with the ethical and moral standards that first do no harm.
There's a direct connection between the increase in painkiller prescriptions and the use of heroin across the U.S. In the case of the kids who became addicted to heroin in Granville in 2004, that connection was known. But still, it wasn't treated as a public health crisis in Granville. It wasn't treated as an outbreak. It was dealt with mainly in one way only, as a crime. In a few minutes, we'll hear how that turned out.
What's the story you've heard? I know you weren't there, but what's the story you heard?
Yeah. Nah, I really don't want to get all into that one. I really don't. That's deep.
This is State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. On October 27th, 1986, President Reagan signed a new law to fight drug use in America. Buried within that law were new penalties for those convicted of selling drugs. The premise behind those penalties was to get the most serious drug offenders off the streets and send a message that dealing drugs in America is a crime that does not pay. Eugene Atkins never got that message.
One thing about Gene always was above everybody else. He always grew up a little faster than the rest of us. I'm Joseph Russall, and I'm definitely a childhood friend of Gene's. We both grew up in the same neighborhood, the wealthy area, wealthy Fuller area, Sigsby.
This is the area teenagers from the suburb of Granville started coming to in the fall of 2004 to get their heroin fix. Many of them arrived here already addicted. And for a few months, until he was caught, Eugene Atkins was the dealer who helped them feed that addiction. Russell says this was a tough place to grow up, but it was also tight-knit.
Everybody knew everybody, like Cheers, man. Everybody knew everybody's name and where they came from. Everybody knew everyone's parents at that time.
Yeah, everyone's happy. All the neighborhood kids, seemed like they were brothers and sisters. They did everything together. They went to school together. On the weekends, they'd all be in the park early in the morning with their pajamas on, playing in the park.
So, this is Felicia Sims. She's Eugene's mom. She told me Eugene was a good kid. He loved animals. He was a class clown. He liked cars. When he was a teenager, he held down a job working in the cafeteria of a hospital. It made him some money, but his mom noticed he bought some things that he shouldn't have been able to afford, and she knew where that extra money was coming from. She tried to get him to stop.
Sometimes he would kind of stay away because, you know, I'd get on him all the time, but, man, just, you know, sometimes kids think they know better than their parents do.
Everybody did it around here. Everybody sold something once upon in their life, their childhood, if you were out here at that time. You sold something. You at least tried to. You tried it.
Okay, y'all can talk. I'm just...
All right. Eugene, you can hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you.
To talk to Eugene Atkins, I had to set up a three-way call through his sister, Tanisha. Eugene still talks to his family a couple times a week when his prison isn't on lockdown.
So, yeah, tell me, first of all, tell me how things are going there. Where are you right now, and how is it?
I'm at USP Hazleton, and it ain't good at all.
Hazleton's a federal penitentiary in the mountains of West Virginia, a 500-mile drive from where Eugene grew up. Hazleton gets some of the most violent criminals in America and in the world. One of Hazleton's most famous inmates is a drug kingpin connected to the Cali drug cartel in Colombia. Joaquin Valencia Trujillo was accused of running a multi-billion dollar drug operation, sending 100 tons of cocaine into the United States every year for about a decade. And right there in the same prison is Eugene Atkins, a street-level dealer from Grand Rapids, picked up when he was 19 years old for selling packets of heroin to other teenagers. The difference at Hazleton between Atkins and the cartel kingpin is the kingpin is scheduled to be released at some point. Atkins is serving life without parole. You're listening to State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. This hour, the story of how Michigan failed to respond to one of the worst epidemics in its history, the epidemic of opiate drug abuse. And we're trying to understand it right now through the story of one of the earliest overdose deaths that happened during this epidemic, when 17-year-old Matthew McKinney of Granville died on December 15, 2004. After Matt died, his mother, Mary DeBoer, told me she tried to get others to pay attention to help make sure no other parents had to feel the pain she felt. She talked to whoever she could about it, school leaders, doctors, addiction experts. But really, only one organization ever listened to her, the U.S. Attorney's Office. After an investigation from local police, the federal prosecutor's office in Grand Rapids quickly zeroed in on who might have been responsible for Matt's death. The person they went after is Eugene Atkins. Atkins admits he was a heroin dealer. He first started selling drugs when he was in the eighth grade. People would come up to him and ask him if they could buy drugs.
Because, I mean, when you're around it all day and you pretty much ain't got nothing to do or nothing in your pockets, and somebody would walk up to you and ask you for something, and you could have easily made a couple dollars. I mean, it's that easy, so you're going to figure out how you can not miss out on a couple dollars next time.
Yeah.
You don't really think about no consequences, nothing like that.
Yeah.
Atkins started selling weed. He moved on to cocaine. Then he got busted the first time. By that time, he should have known. Everyone told him to stop dealing. His closest friends, his mom. And the laws don't look kindly on second-time drug offenders. Eugene knew that. He was still a teenager. But he knew that. But, as Gene tells the story now, that first stint in prison is actually why he became a heroin dealer.
It's a funny story because I seen a movie and then somebody approached me while I was locked up and we was talking. You know, when you were locked up, a lot of people tell stories. So people was telling stories about drugs they use and all that stuff. When I got out, I bumped into this particular person. And I really hadn't learned nothing about it. Still to this day, I really don't know too much about it. I just knew how to get it and who to sell it to, who wanted it.
What Atkins didn't know back then is that switching from dealing cocaine to dealing heroin isn't just a business decision. Heroin is a much more dangerous drug. It's more addictive than other drugs. It kills far more people. Matthew McKinney was not a heavy heroin user. It's possible he only tried the drug a few times. On December 14, 2004, he snuck out of his parents' house, hopped in the car with his friend Chris Perrin, and they went to get high. Call records on Perrin's phone would show a number of calls to Eugene Atkins that night. Perrin would later testify in court that Matt shot up around 10 p.m., right before getting a call from his mother, reminding them that his curfew was up. Matt told his mother he'd be home soon. Minutes later, he was passed out, his sleeve still rolled up. Chris Perrin kept driving. He stopped at Meyer, flirted with a girl inside. He drove to his mom's house to call his aunt for her birthday. He had a long argument with his girlfriend and talked it over with his mom. And the entire time, Matthew McKinney was passed out in the car. He had no coat. It was 19 degrees outside that night. Perrin would say he checked on Matt a few times. He heard Matt snoring, a sign of a person struggling to breathe during an overdose. At one point, Chris tried to move his friend to get him inside, but he said Matt was too heavy. Sometime around 2:30 a.m., Perrin and his mother went down to the parked car and put blankets over Matt. Less than 5 hours later, Matt was found dead.
We initially entered into an agreement with Eugene Atkins to have him cooperate against Chris Perrin, who was with Matt McKinney at the time and who was originally interviewed by law enforcement and was not truthful with law enforcement.
Ray Beckering is assistant U.S. attorney for the Western District of Michigan. He was the attorney who prosecuted Eugene Atkins.
And it was always our intention to prosecute Chris Perrin to the full extent of the law and to actually cut our deal first and foremost with Eugene Atkins and prosecute Chris Perrin for his culpability as well.
Beckering says Perrin could have been charged for lying. He actually was charged for lying, but he only served 2 years for it. And as for the rest, it's not exactly illegal to leave an unconscious person in a freezing cold car all night. But there is a special section in the 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act that outlines the penalties for anyone convicted of selling drugs that result in serious injury or death. The minimum sentence is 20 years in prison. But if you have a prior conviction for selling drugs, like Eugene Atkins did, the minimum sentence is life in prison. The U.S. Attorney's Office offered Atkins a deal that would have avoided that mandatory life sentence. Eugene Atkins took that deal and pled guilty at first.
And I really pretty much took it out of fear because my lawyer kept telling me, you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison. You're going to go in there in front of that jury. Most of them is going to be white people that don't understand and they ain't even going to be trying to really decipher the facts. And they going to convict you, and then you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison.
Atkins knew he was guilty of selling heroin, but he didn't believe he was the one who sold the heroin that killed Matt McKinney. He still doesn't believe it. And he says the more he thought about that plea deal, the worse he felt about it. So he took it back. He wrote a letter to the judge in the case. He begged that his guilty plea be tossed out. He asked for a new lawyer and a trial. He did this because he believed, and he still believes, that even though he dealt heroin regularly to kids in Granville, he wasn't the one who dealt the heroin that killed Matt McKinney.
Yeah. He said our other friend sold it to him. From day one, he said that, y'all.
This is Joe Russo again. He's one of Gene's closest friends. He's also friends with the other person, the person who frequently sold heroin alongside Gene. Russo told me the story around the neighborhood was that this other friend is the one who actually dealt the drugs the night Matt McKinney died. And this friend's name came up at Eugene's trial, and I'm only going to use his first name here because I haven't found any hard evidence to suggest he had anything to do with the death of Matthew McKinney. But this friend's name is Ryan, and after Eugene Atkins went to prison, Joe Russo says he and other friends from the neighborhood talked to Ryan about his role in the case a lot. It weighed on Ryan.
He got depressed over it. He was messed up a little bit.
Because you think he knew?
Well, yeah, it was a lot of people putting pressure on him to do that, and he wasn't going for it.
Because he said that he didn't do it?
No, because he didn't want to go to jail. He thought he was going to go to jail for it. And he seen the charges Gene was facing. He was scared. He was like, no, he wasn't going for it.
So hang on. Does Ryan say to you that he was the one who gave drugs to that kid that night?
Well,
what's the story you've heard? I know you weren't there, but what's the story you heard?
Yeah, Nah, I really don't want to get all into that one. I really don't. That's deep.
Tell me why you don't want to get into. You don't have to tell me like what the thing is, but like what's after all these years? You believe your friend Gene?
Yeah.
You believe your friend Gene didn't give those drugs that killed that kid?
You gotta remember, these are people I love, and a lot of things with it. It's some things is just not to be told. It's just you need to get the information from that person. I'd rather them tell it than I tell it. It's that serious, you know.
The people investigating the death of Matthew McKinney never interviewed Ryan. They never collected his phone records to see where he was the night Matt died. I sent a letter to Ryan in June asking if he'd talk with me. He's in state prison now, serving a sentence for assault. I never heard back from Ryan. I asked Ray Beckering, the prosecutor, about this side of the story. He told me investigators had the phone records for Eugene, for Matt, and for Matt's friend, Chris Perrin, from that night. There were no calls to Ryan, only Eugene. So to the idea that Eugene Atkins wasn't responsible for Matt McKinney's death...
All I could say is that the phone records established differently, the witnesses, eyewitnesses established differently, and the jury certainly found differently.
When the jury found Eugene Atkins guilty of dealing the heroin that killed Matt McKinney, Matt's mom, Mary DeBoer, felt, for a little while, a small sense of relief. The verdict came more than a year after her son's death. And since then, she'd been trying everything she could to get people to pay attention to the problem of drug addiction in Granville. And here, finally, was something she could say that had been done about it.
It was a relief that there was justice and that Matt got justice and that this kid wouldn't be on the streets hurting anybody else anymore. But at the same time, it was very painful because, you know, I look across the courtroom and here's this mom who's also losing her son now.
It was hard because I could feel her pain, but at the same time, you know, I'm feeling like, you know, I'm losing my son too because he's finna go. But I mean, if he did it, fine, you know, because I've always taught my kids right from wrong. Because I was like, if he did it and he had to be convicted of it, fine, but he didn't do it. So don't take my kid for something he didn't do.
Mary DeBoer still believes the evidence against Eugene Atkins. She believes he's responsible for her son's death. When I told her Gene's side of things, more than anything, she seemed hurt that he hasn't admitted it yet. Still, the way she felt years ago, she doesn't feel that way anymore. She no longer thinks Eugene Atkins should spend the rest of his life in prison.
I would like to give his mom a chance to have her son back for a little bit. I really would.
You think so? Do you think that's possible?
I don't know.
There was one other person who could say for sure what happened that night. Chris Perrin. He was the one who drove the car to go buy the drugs. He was with Matt when Matt used the drugs. He's the one who left Matt in the car in the cold for hours while Matt overdosed. Chris Perrin was the main witness in the trial against Eugene Atkins. But Chris can't tell us anything now about what happened that night in 2004. Chris died just a few months ago. His family told me it was a heroin overdose.
He would have nightmares.
This is Chris's former girlfriend, Amanda.
And he'd wake up like either crying or sweating or just somehow bothered by it in whatever way and tell me that, you know, he had a dream about Matt, and then he wouldn't really want to elaborate on it any further. But it happened a lot.
Amanda isn't just an old girlfriend. She's the mother of two of Chris's three kids. We sat in the shade at Heritage Park in Granville while the kids played on the playground. Amanda told me Chris loved Matt, and it weighed on Chris that nearly everyone he knew blamed him for the death of his friend, that he blamed himself for not doing more to help Matt, and that he never overcame his own addiction.
I always will, and I always have, felt like Chris is my soulmate. Even through everything that, all the pain that he caused me, and all the hurt and all that stuff, he had a heart of gold. He was an amazing person when he was sober, but his demons were bigger than he was, and his addiction took his life. Took him away from his kids, took him away from us, and it just consumed him.
Of the kids in Granville who started using heroin around 2004, at least four are now dead. Others tell me the number's much higher. And many are still battling their addiction. No one's addiction ended when Eugene Atkins went to prison.
Did you ever feel like there was something that could have helped him, that something that someone just didn't try, or some treatment he didn't get, that what, you know, was there anything that you felt like someone could have done?
I feel like if it would have been dealt with when he was younger, it would have been a totally different story. And I don't even mean that by him being younger. If it would have been dealt with better at the beginning of his addiction rather than just being brushed underneath the rug all the time. But that's just something that I've encountered with all heroin addicts that I've dealt with, that if their families didn't just try to brush it under the rug, or people that they loved, or even prisons or rehab facilities, if they just didn't...
Schools,
everything. If they didn't just brush this stuff underneath the rug and they talked about it and they put it out there...
That hasn't been the approach now for at least a decade. The opiate epidemic that's taken the lives of Chris Perrin, Matt McKinney, and thousands of others in Michigan has been dealt with as a criminal issue when it's been dealt with at all. That approach wasn't enough to stop the problem. But more than a decade into this crisis, some people are ready to try something new.
We're at that epidemic level where innovation is going to lead us out of this.
This is State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. We're talking this hour about how Michigan failed to respond to one of the worst epidemics in its history. It's been a decade, maybe more. Thousands have died. Many more had their lives destroyed. It's been a national epidemic, but Michigan has been especially hard hit. It's an epidemic of drug addiction to opiates. And while Michigan has been one of the worst places for this epidemic, it has not been a place on the forefront of finding solutions. So I went on a trip.
So what are you doing today?
It's rebuilding traps. Ready to catch lobsters.
How are the lobsters this year?
It's a little slow right now because of the weather.
In Gloucester, Massachusetts, I walk down to the harbor and find a man who gives his name as Scott. I told him I'm in town to talk about heroin addiction.
You see a lot of that out here?
Oh, yeah, that's a lot. Too much.
Too much. So what do you see?
Oh, needles all over the ground. I mean, it's bad around here. It really is. It's a shame these young kids are getting hooked on heroin. It's bad. I got a young son, and it scares me.
I walk a couple blocks up the street, and I stop into a place called the Two Sisters Coffee Shop to get some breakfast. I order some pancakes, and then I hear the people around me all talking about heroin.
My daughter, she had surgery, and they gave her OxyContin.
Brad Pierce sat with his wife, Lindsay, finishing up their coffee.
And then she still had a problem after that, and they gave her another prescription, and then another prescription, and then she got hooked on that. And it's very simple. You know, she was a 4.0 student in college, and it's because of the surgery, and the doctor's just giving prescriptions out to ease the pain, and she got hooked on it. And then she went from that. It was cheaper to get heroin, and then it was... methadone, and what was the other treatment that she went through?
Suboxone.
She liked that, and that got expensive. And then now she swears she's fine and she's clean, but we can't tell. We've lost so many people that have died. Yeah. What? How many this year in Gloucester?
My son's.
This is Patty Philbrick, the owner of the Two Sisters Coffee Shop.
My son is 31, so he's probably lost in the past 10 years probably 10 friends. And they still don't learn. And they still go out and do it. And when somebody overdoses and dies, they want to go get that dope from that person because that was good stuff because it killed somebody. That's how crazy that drug is.
Stories like this, unfortunately, aren't just in Gloucester. They're everywhere. The reason I went to Gloucester is because a few months ago, after a community meeting to discuss yet another round of deadly overdoses in the town, the Gloucester Police Department announced that it was going to try a new approach to handle the problem. This new approach was announced first on Facebook, and it was so simple, so obvious, and yet so radically different that this Facebook post was shared millions of times. It made national news. And the approach is this. Going forward, any addict who shows up at the Gloucester Police Department headquarters and asks for help will immediately get that help. The department has lined up volunteer addiction sponsors. They call them angels. It's lined up treatment centers willing to take addicts in for detox. And the people who turn themselves in, even if they have drugs on them, won't be arrested.
We're at that epidemic level where innovation is going to lead us out of this.
Leonard Campanello is chief of the Gloucester Police Department. I sit down in his office overlooking the harbor on a Friday morning. He's in jeans, sitting behind a desk covered in papers. When I ask how his day's going, he says, you know, drinking from the fire hose. Life is always busy for a small-town police chief, but it's been especially busy for Campanello ever since his department announced his new policy on Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, we got a reaction that we never expected. I think within 4 or 5 days, we had 2.2 million individual hits on our own Facebook page, and we know that, you know, in today's world, 2.2 million hits is yesterday's 2.2 million signatures on a referendum. So we were, you know, for a small city police department, we were immediately overwhelmed and really knew we had hit a nerve.
What's your take on why you hit a nerve? Why do you think this has been something that people have shared worldwide?
I think that people are recognizing, whether it be through their own experiences, which are becoming more widespread, or the evidence that's being medically produced, that addiction is not a choice, it's not a crime, and it's a disease, and it needs to be treated as such. And so our response from the people, or our post to the people, tapped into something that they had been feeling all along, which is they don't want their police departments to arrest the user who is suffering from this addiction. They want more avenues to help.
One problem, though, is how to pay for that help. A number of treatment centers stepped up and offered to help with detox, but that's just the first step. Long-term treatment is expensive. That's part of why so many people never get it. It's not unusual to hear about people putting a second mortgage on their home to pay for rehab, which can cost tens of thousands of dollars. Campanello says the problem of how to pay for treatment hasn't been solved, but he knows who he's going to ask for help.
We have the anticipation that entities that are involved in this, insurance companies and pharmaceuticals, will step up and clean up the mess they've made. You know, we've made comparisons, you know, pharmaceuticals to the Exxon Valdez. You know what I mean? You know, there was a mess created, and no one starts with a needle in their hand. We want to bring them to the table because we think they're part of the solution. And the solution is not only clean up the mess you made, but you got to wipe down every penguin that got oil on it. Or, you know, and in this case, every person that started out with a prescribed drug from a doctor and ended up with a needle in their arm.
As of last week, 32 people have gotten help through the Angel program, according to the Gloucester Police Department. And in June, Campanello co-launched a new nationwide nonprofit group called the Police Assisted Addiction and Recovery Initiative. Its goal is to spread the idea of the Angel program to police departments across the country. You're listening to State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. This hour, we're hearing about how Michigan failed to respond to one of the worst public health epidemics in its history, and how that response might finally change to end the epidemic. Earlier, we heard what happened after an outbreak of heroin addiction in the town of Granville, Michigan in 2004. But as I've said many times, Granville wasn't the only city in Michigan to see this problem. So now I want to talk about what happened when this problem hit the town of Fraser in Macomb County.
Well, Ryan, at 16, he was everything you wanted.
Mark Rudolph sat down with me in his living room for what by now has become a familiar story. The story of how his child, died from a drug overdose.
I mean, he was working as many hours as he could find, had his own car, getting decent grades in school. But somewhere between 16 and a half, I don't know what happened.
Ryan started getting into drugs. That much Mark and Ryan's mom knew. They tried to get him help. At one point, their son was arrested. They planned to pick him up the day he was released from jail to drive him straight to a rehab facility. But Mark says the jail let his son out one day early. Ryan found his own way to heroin. Then Ryan's mom got a message on her phone telling her where she could find Ryan's body.
Ryan's half-brother went to that location, and sure enough, he was rolled up in a rug and just dumped.
It was one of many overdoses of Fraser kids that year. As anger over the problem spread, someone called a community meeting. It was held in the basement of a local church.
There was just a bunch of pissed off people in the basement of this church.
Mark says it was about 80 people altogether, mostly just shouting at each other. But then
there was a group of recovering young people there. And one of them said, "Let us talk to your kids." Somewhere in that, the conversation kind of left that and went around to other topics. And then I finally said, "You know, are we listening to these kids over here? Because they're the only one." I'm sorry. Because they're the only ones that are saying anything different. Rick Rapicki, who was the superintendent of schools at the time, said, "I'll make it happen."
Rudolph says this was in November. By December, he and the young recovering addicts were in the high school talking openly about drug addiction. And it might not sound like a huge deal, but it was surprisingly rare. After her son Matthew McKinney died in Granville in 2004, Mary DeBoer wanted to do almost this exact same thing, go into a high school and talk about the dangers of addiction. She says she was allowed in once, and after that, she couldn't convince any school to let her talk about the problem that had claimed her son's life. Mark Rudolph says he saw the same kind of indifference in Southeast Michigan.
Fraser was about the only... Fraser and Tower High School, which is in Warren, were the only two high schools that would let us in to speak to their students. We put together a package, then we sent it to every superintendent in Macomb County. We didn't get one reply, not a single reply from any of them.
Do you find, or what explanation do you have for not getting a response, for not having anyone want to talk about this?
Most of them, I think, are there with schools of choice especially. They're afraid to admit that they have a drug problem. I believe that from the depths of my heart.
But when parents, school leaders, and community leaders started really talking about the problem in Fraser, things actually changed. Out of that one meeting in the church basement in 2007, a new organization was born, Families Against Narcotics, or FAN.
That's fine. That's good. Good, good, good.
In May, I went to FAN's monthly meeting in Fraser and met with FAN's executive director, Andrew Fortunato.
This is the same church basement that they met in that very first night 7 years ago. And said, "Well, what are we going to do?"
FAN has been growing since that night. There are now FAN chapters across the state. FAN has been at the center of pushing for a change in the response to the opiate crisis in Michigan. And people stay active. There were about 100 people in the church basement for that May meeting I went to. I didn't record the meeting. Many people shared deeply personal details. And it's clear that the effects of the opiate epidemic on this community are still raging. But in Fraser, unlike many other places, people are actually getting together and talking about it, supporting one another.
It's refreshing each and every month that we have one of these monthly meetings because it's not always what you get out there. There's a lot of stigma, and there's a lot of, on everybody's part, what does it say about me as a parent if I raise an addict? What does it say about me if I am an addict? People look at me weird because I am. And all that gets erased down here, and we just get to be people for a minute, learn from each other, be accepting of one another, and try to figure out what to do about the situation that we find ourselves in.
Fortunato tells me one of the most important parts of this meeting is that it isn't just addicts and their families who show up. It's not just people who manage recovery programs. It's not just police officers. It's not just judges and lawyers. It's everyone together.
I say that because it's important that it is. It's such a comprehensive, systemic problem that this is what's necessary for the solution, right? It affects everybody in our society, and if not you directly, then you definitely indirectly.
FAN is one organization that's been able to bring people together who each have a role to play in solving the epidemic. And that movement is just starting to gain traction.
I am actually, for the first time, very optimistic.
Linda Davis is president of FAN and a judge in Macomb County. She says the first 2 years of FAN, she felt like she was banging her head against a wall. But just in the past year and a half, suddenly, things have changed. People are finally willing to talk about the problem of opiate addiction.
Sorry, I have to ask, like, what changed? That you've been trying to get these meetings for years. What changed all of a sudden the last year and a half?
I just think that we kept beating the doors down and talking and educating enough people that you get to the right people, you make the right connections, and all of a sudden it just starts pulling together and it happens.
Like last year, Michigan passed a new law that allows more people to get prescriptions for a drug called naloxone. It works like an antidote to a drug overdose, reviving someone who's slipping away. Because of that law, naloxone is now in every Macomb County Sheriff's Office vehicle. Many other sheriff's offices and police departments are following suit. And parents can now get naloxone to give to their children. This will save lives. But when I ask Davis what else Michigan should be doing to stop the epidemic and stop the deaths, she has a long to-do list.
Well, number one, it needs to be, I think naloxone should be written every time a script is written for an opiate. So that would be one thing that I would want to see change. We need more treatment dollars so that we can make treatment available. We need to work with the insurance companies to make sure that they are regulating how much of this stuff is being written and turning over doctors that are over-prescribing. We need legislation based on how many pills can be written, requiring doctors to map every patient that comes through if they're giving them narcotics. That should be a mandatory thing that everybody is mapped.
Running a MAPS report on patients, that last item on her list could be a big one. Michigan has a database for every prescription that's written in the state. It's called the Michigan Automated Prescription System, or MAPS. It's there specifically so doctors can check and make sure they're not giving a patient something that will put them at risk. The database can also show which patients have an addiction problem, if they're getting opiates from more than one doctor, for example. And lots of doctors have started checking this database before writing a prescription for an opiate. But not everyone does it, and it's not mandatory. Some doctors, Davis says, especially dentists, don't even know the database exists. Other states that have mandated checking these kinds of databases have seen drastic reductions in drug overdoses. Michigan has yet to take this step. Michigan has barely even started talking about the problem.
That's the biggest problem, is we need to break the silence. You know, people are ashamed if they're an addict. Families are ashamed if they have an addict living with them. This is a disease. It's nothing to be ashamed of. It's nothing to ignore. And I think that once we start opening up the lines of communication about this, you start talking about this topic with people, you're going to be shocked at how many people you meet that are dealing with this on a personal level. It's rampant.
In June, Governor Snyder appointed a new task force to look at how Michigan can respond to the opiate epidemic. Judge Linda Davis is on that task force. The governor said in his State of the State address this year that he'd like to see policy proposals by the fall. Many of the ideas are already out there. Other states have had task forces. Other states have passed laws. Other states have responded, at least in some way, to this deadly epidemic. After years of failing to respond, Michigan is starting to change course. You've been listening to State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. Tamar Charney is executive producer of State of Opportunity. Vincent Duffy is our news director. Sarah Hewlett edited this documentary. The State of Opportunity team is Sarah Alvarez, Jennifer Guerra, and Brittany Bartoviak. Mark Brush, Kimberly Springer, and Carolyn Gehrig worked on the digital version of this story. Special thanks to my friend Chris Zolads at WZZM13 in Grand Rapids for help with research. I'm Dustin Dwyer.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, our partner with communities where children come first.